tonight on Arena. Viet Thanh Nguyen on his memoir, A Man of Two Faces, and new albums from Elbow, Gossip and the Jesus and Mary Chain up for review. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Viet Thanh Nguyen was born in what was previously known as South Vietnam in 1971. 4 years later, after the fall of Saigon, his family was forced to flee to the United States as refugees, eventually settling in California. His first novel, The Sympathizer, was an ambitious, disturbing book that explored the aftermath of the Vietnam War through the eyes of a Communist Party spy who escaped Saigon for California. The Sympathizer appeared on 30 Best of the Year lists in 2016, won numerous awards, including the Pulitzer Prize, and Nguyen followed it up with a sequel called The Committed. His new title, A Man of Two Faces, is a memoir that traces Nguyen's personal journey, with a title drawn directly from the opening line of The Sympathizer. A Man of Two Faces sees Nguyen delve into the core of his being, unravelling the intricacies of his life and exploring the necessity of both remembering and forgetting. Delighted to have Viet Thanh Nguyen join me on the programme this evening. I love the idea that this is as much about forgetting Nguyen as it is about remembering. I think you were, am I right in saying you're perhaps a reluctant memoirist?
Hi, Sean. It's a pleasure to be here with you again. You're absolutely a reluctant memoirist. I think anybody who's an enthusiastic memoirist is a person to be distrusted. I always thought my parents' lives were much more dramatic and interesting than mine because they went through 40 years of war, famine, colonization, and being refugees twice, and all I did was become a writer. So it took me a long time to grapple with my parents' lives and their impact on me. Mm. And the memoir is as much about them as it is about me.
There you go, robbing my second question on me. It isn't about you. This is about your parents. So thank you for setting that up so well for us. But it strikes me it is about two aspects. Well, it's about loads of aspects, obviously, of your parents' life. But a bit like the remembering and forgetting being part of what the memoir is about, this is as much about really examining everything that your parents did and didn't do and said and didn't say as it is about honouring them, because it quite definitely honours them. But all of those other questions are in there in what you're doing as well.
You know what I've come to understand both about my own life, but about the lives of many others, of children and grandchildren and people who've undergone terrible things, is that sometimes our parents and grandparents will tell us stories about their past. And those are affecting enough because for many of us, we've been so far removed from these traumatic experiences of an earlier generation. But oftentimes they refuse to speak or they won't speak. And I think that the silences, the absences themselves transmit feeling and emotion. And, at least in my case, left me oftentimes quite confused about who I was and what had happened to my parents. And that absent presence of the past and of unspoken memory, whether my parents didn't remember certain things or whether they refused to remember certain things, whether they just didn't want to share them with me, that really has shaped my life.
In the writing of the book itself, then, did you come to realize that there are certain things that you don't want to remember or that you can't bring yourself into that space, possibly because it's too difficult a place to go to?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a writer, but also a scholar. So I certainly know the importance of investigating the past and reconstructing it. And there's a certain element of that in this book as I talk about the war in Vietnam and its, the shaping of a Vietnamese refugee diaspora that I find myself in and the shaping of my family. However, beyond those historical contours, every family is different. Every family is individual. And what happened to my own family, with my mother in particular, was that she was a wonderful woman who was very successful, but she also went to the mental facilities three times in her life. And I wrote about one of those incidences when I was in college, so I certainly knew about it at the time. I put away that essay, did not look at it again for 30 years until the pandemic. And in the intervening period, I remembered that my mother had gone to this mental facility when I was a little boy. Then I returned to the essay, read it, and realized that was when I was 18 years old. So my own memory had completely distorted what had actually happened, because I think I was so deeply affected by watching my mother in this mental facility. And that gave me the understanding of how distorting our own memories can be. It's easy to point to someone else and say, they've completely changed the past. But in my case, I changed the past. And so I tried to reconstruct certain things. But when my mother returned to that mental facility for the third time, about 15 years ago, I could not remember a thing afterwards. And I was a grown adult. Mm. And so I've left certain, I did not try to reconstruct that visit, because sometimes I think that for me, at least, there is a blankness in my memory that has been the effect of this trauma in my family's life. And I want to leave that blank space there, because that's how some of us do experience the past.
For example, I mean, you say that you have no memory of your crossing the ocean, even of that what must have been an incredibly difficult journey for your parents and for you. I know you were very young at the time, but there's nothing there from that period. Do you have a sense that it is in a box that either you or some part of yourself that's looking after you has decided to keep closed, and that you're in agreement with that, or that you just can't go there, or you don't have the facility to actually pick at something and see if it's there?
Yeah, I was actually present at the fall of Saigon, but I was 4 years old, so I wonder if I can be counted as an eyewitness to the fall of Saigon if I actually cannot remember it. And so, yes, we did cross the ocean, and we ended up in a refugee camp in Pennsylvania. And that's where my memories begin, because in order to leave this camp, refugees had to be sponsored by Americans. And there was nobody willing to take all four of us and our family. So I was separated from my parents. And I remember my first memories are of howling and screaming as I'm being taken away. That's where memories begin. And I'm the father of a 4-year-old and a 10-year-old now. And at each of those moments when they turned 4, it was the occasion for me to think about myself and about them. And I think that even if you can't remember your life at 4 years of age, the emotional reverberations that have been taking place around you at 1, 2, 3, 4 years, those do shape you. Those do form, as you said, a box inside of yourself, which you may never be able to tap consciously, but which I strongly believe are there for us unconsciously. And so I do think that I was shaped by that refugee experience, even if I cannot actually remember it.
I don't know if it's fair to talk about secrets in the way you've just described those memories that are, you know, potentially there, but in this box, for whatever reason they're in the box, be that consciously locked away or the subconscious holding them back for our own mental health, perhaps. But you kept secrets from your parents, and your parents kept secrets from you.
Well, the definition of a secret is you don't know it actually exists. So as far as I know, my parents had many secrets from me. You know, when you uncover a secret, then it really isn't that much of a secret anymore. But in my case, certainly I was raised by parents who were devoutly Catholic and devoutly capitalist. And they did their best to turn me into a Catholic capitalist, and it didn't work. You know, I went to Catholic school my entire life, and I turned out an atheist. And my parents were very successful business people, and I turned out a Marxist. And they wanted to have a doctor, and I turned out to be a writer. So, I mean, in many ways, I disappointed my parents, and I tried to, you know, prevent them from feeling as much disappointment as possible by not telling them certain things. So they never learned that I was an atheist, for example. And they never learned that I wanted to be a writer until, in fact, I published The Sympathizer, and then it became public knowledge. So in many ways, I think secrets, you know, can be held for nefarious purposes, for purposes of deception. But sometimes I do believe that we keep secrets from our loved ones in order to protect them as well. And I think probably my parents have protected me with secrets I will never know about. And in turn, and for example, with atheism, did my parents really need to know that I was an atheist? Yeah. That would have really devastated them. So it was perfectly fine to keep that a secret from them, that I was not the son.
I loved that idea that you articulate so well, this idea that it is about protection both ways, a two-way protection. There was an incredible sadness, and even though there was a meeting later on in life, that your parents and indeed the family, as they left Saigon at that time, they had to leave behind their adoptive daughter, who she was a teenager at that time, wasn't she?
She was probably about 16, 15 years old. So what happened was our hometown of Ban Mintuat was the first town captured in the final invasion of 1975. And my father was in Saigon. My mother had to make a life and death decision, and she decided to leave with my brother and me and leave behind our adopted sister to take care of the family property, assuming we would come back. But we didn't, obviously, and I would not see her again for 28 years. So obviously, I knew who she was. I was 4 years old, but I forgot about her until one day when I was maybe 10 or 11. We get a letter in the mail, and it's from her, and there's a picture of this young, beautiful woman. And that was the beginning of my knowledge that we had left somebody behind. And that's another one of those absent presences that I felt haunted my life and shaped me as a writer, because I had to grapple with these absent presences. And I think, wondering in the back of my mind, what if I had been the one left behind? And I think that question is a common one for those of us who have been through these kinds of experiences.
And I wonder, as you watch the news today, two particular conflicts spring to mind. Obviously, the Ukrainian-Russian conflict, and the number of people that have had to leave their homes in Ukraine, and also this current situation in Gaza, which has had landed you into a kind of trouble. I think it's fair to say, in late 2023, when you called for a ceasefire along with 750 other writers. And one of your an event that you were involved in was cancelled as a direct result of that calling for a ceasefire.
I think it was twofold. I did sign that ceasefire letter, and the institution that canceled me, a very famous one in New York City, 92NY, which has a very famous writer series, but it's explicitly a Jewish institution. That's a part of its description. But I think the other aspect of it was, in addition to signing that ceasefire letter, I publicly proclaimed on Instagram that I'm still committed to the cause of boycott, divestment, sanctions, BDS, which I had signed on to around 2015 or 2016. And I think that for me, boycott, divestment, sanctions is a nonviolent movement. It's better than violence. And yet, the advocates for Israel and Israel itself obviously are intent on suppressing any kind of public disagreement or dissidence with their particular political and military agenda. And I, as an American, feel complicit because our taxes are paying for the billion, literally billions of dollars of weapons and aid that is being sent to Israel to carry out this campaign that has killed 31,000 Gazans, or even by Netanyahu's estimate, 28,000, if you take that number. And also, we are witnessing a situation where, according to every reliable nonpartisan aid organization, 1.1 million Palestinians are on the brink of famine. And there's enough food outside of Gaza on trucks ready to get in, but Israel will not allow enough aid to arrive. So I think it's a moral and politically urgent scenario. And also, as someone, a Vietnamese refugee, I feel for any country that is being bombed by American weapons.
Which I wondered, obviously that's a very strong political standpoint that you've given us in on a purely personal level. I don't want to be in any way crass about this, but how triggering or how difficult is it for you to watch the pictures that we see on our television screens on a daily basis? Does that start to trigger memories in any type of way?
I think it's unbelievable to see what we're seeing. And it's not even what we're seeing. I actually have to turn the volume down sometimes because it's actually the hearing of the cries and the parents and the children that I find incredibly affecting as well. And it is triggering because you see some of these images of survivors being pulled out of the rubble, covered with soot and burned and things like this. And of course, again, I was too young to remember this, but I've done a lot of research into the war in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. And you read about what was happening back then, and you read the eyewitness reports, both of Vietnamese people, but also of foreign journalists and aid workers and so on. It's very much the same in terms of the horrors they're describing about being hit by American bombs or American napalm and children being killed or deformed and so on. And so, yes, it is deeply triggering and provocative for me. And so, if I'm making strong political statements, it's because I think the situation warrants those statements.
One final question. I mean, there are about 27 final questions I want to ask you, but I just can't do that, unfortunately. You keep, I think, possibly the most repeated phrase in the book is, "This is a war story." this is a war story, which you say several times at different points along the way. Why was that aspect of your own life and your own story so important to constantly reiterate for us, the reader?
Two reasons why, I think. Number one is that the war in Vietnam killed about 58,000 American soldiers and about 3 million Vietnamese people, the majority of whom were civilians. Do those civilian stories count as war stories? I think they do. You know, I see the damages of war inflicted on my parents and so many other people in the Vietnamese refugee community who are not soldiers at all. And I think that the human consequences of that, of being bombed, of being displaced, of being turned into refugees, of witnessing things being done to other people, these are war stories. And the other reason why I make this claim is because it's very interesting for me to think about when wars begin and when wars end. I think it's a very human impulse to say there has to be a definitive beginning and an end to a war. But in my experience, wars foreshadow other wars, and we don't even know when wars really end, because for Vietnamese refugees and for Americans, even after 1975, I felt the war was not actually over. People were still fighting the war over again in memory. They were deeply traumatized on all sides. And the consequences of that trauma could be very personal for their family members and relatives. But if we look at what happens at the dimension of nation states, America's unworked trauma from the Vietnam War is still having consequences today in the kinds of wars that America chooses to fight and supports.
And as we speak right now, there's a news flash coming on Sky News here in Ireland, 40 dead and more than 100 wounded in a Moscow concert hall attack. I'm hazarding a guess that we are not talking about soldiers who are in that concert hall. That civilian aspect of it, of war, goes on and on in the present day.
Wars cannot be contained, and war crimes are not owned by any particular country. Everybody can commit a war crime, and we should always call out war crimes against civilians and children and innocents, no matter who's doing them. And we also have to, unfortunately, have a sense of proportion that 1,200 Israeli dead and 31,000 Palestinian dead have to be held in contrast with each other.
Viet Thanh Nguyen, I really could talk to you for another half hour, but sadly, I can't. Thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
That's Viet Thanh Wang, and his new book is called A Man of Two Faces. It is published by Corsair. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. The Hunter is the ninth novel from best-selling author Tana French, a sequel to her 2020 book The Searcher, which introduced us to the characters of Cal Hooper, a retired cop from Chicago, and Trey Reddy, a half-wild teenager living in the west of Ireland. The two struck up a friendship in The Searcher when Cal moved to Trey's village, Ardnakelty, and looking for a quiet life and getting anything but that when Trey's brother Brendan went missing. The Hunter picks up 2 years on. This time, Trey's errant father, Johnny, turns up out of the blue, back from London with tall tales on a treasure hunt for gold. That's not going to do anybody any good. Delighted to have Tana French with me in studio this evening. Yeah, we'll come to Johnny come lately. We'll come to him in a moment. But maybe for those who are not familiar with The Searcher, Tana, tell us a little bit about Cal and this wonderful relationship that grew up between them. They kind of became a family, really, didn't they? Or they certainly are in this novel.
Yeah, they've turned into a kind of odd makeshift family put together from whatever bits and bobs are there. Cal came over to Ardnakelty. He was just looking for peace and quiet to be left alone in The Searcher. And instead, this, as you say, half-wild teenager shows up demanding that he go look for her missing brother, which he does. But of course, it doesn't end well because it's that kind of book. In this one, it's 2 years later and Cal has struck up a relationship with a local woman called Lena. And the two of them have found themselves kind of raising Trey, more or less, turning her from this feral kid into a good kid, going good places. But then Trey's dad, who's been away for years and who is, let's face it, even more useless when he's there than when he's not, shows up. He's got a plan, he's got a scheme, and he wants Trey on board. He figures Trey could be useful.
He's got a scheme which has to do with looking for gold in them there hills type of thing, which gives us a sense, I suppose, the fact that the gold digger aspect of it is, it is very contemporary, but it has the feel of a Western off it, as does, you know, Cal, the kind of the outsider coming into town from somewhere else. That has the feeling of a Western to it too. And the fact that he's a lawman adds to all of that. I think the Western was in your mind in The Searcher, and it's still there in this.
Ah, oh, definitely. I think the pair of them are kind of mystery software running on Western hardware. Do you know what I mean? Just, I fell in love with Westerns accidentally when I read Lonesome Dove, and then spread out like Two Grit and The Sisters Brothers. And what, this is an amazing genre, and it's got so many tropes that are oddly would map really interestingly onto the west of Ireland, because you've got so much in common there. You've got that sense of a place that's kind of removed from the centres of power, both culturally and geographically, so that people feel like the power brokers don't really care about them, don't understand their lives, don't care about them. And if they want a functioning society, they're going to have to make and enforce their own rules. Mm. So in The Searcher, I was sort of playing with, yeah, the stranger in town. He rolls into the saloon and he's probably got a past and things are going to change around him. He's going to be a catalyst for change. But in this one, I was thinking about that gold rush trope that you get in Westerns.
Yeah.
And it seems like a weird match for Ireland, but it's not really, because we do have more ancient gold artefacts than almost anyone. And there have been little mini gold rushes through the centuries in unexpected places like Wicklow. Do you know what I mean? And there's still people finding gold in the mountains. So I thought, right, if Johnny's going to come back,
yeah,
he sounds like the kind who's going to come back with some get-rich-quick plan. So what about gold?
And the chap he has with him.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He's brought along an English millionaire, just, you know, and a lot of trouble.
A lot of trouble. So that is going on. And we found out more about the Brendan situation, which we won't go into, because people who... I think it's well worth reading The Searcher. If you're coming to stuff this totally new, it's well worth reading The Searcher before you come to The Hunter. I mean, you can possibly start at The Hunter, but knowing that background is very useful.
Yeah, I'm aiming for it to be that either one will work on its own. Mm. But yeah, it would definitely add probably a little extra layer if you knew how they all got there.
That aspect of the West, I mean, I'm thinking of the Dublin Murder Squad books, which was, you know, from the start was really what launched you into full flight as a writer. And obviously the more recent TV series brought it to another place as well. And it's maybe opened up the reading of the books again to people who saw the TV series. You started The Searcher and you thought, this is a standalone book. I'm doing one.
Yep.
What? Definitely. Who was it? Who came knocking at the writer's door? Was it Cal? Was it Trey? Or was it the two of them together?
It was the three of them. It was that relationship between Lena and Cal and Trey. I just want that relationship. At the end of The Searcher, it's in a really fragile place. And it's really interesting where it's going to go and what happens if something comes barreling into that relationship before it's solidified, before it's set firm. Mm. And that's why this one's got three narrators instead of just one, because it's not a book about one person the way The Searcher was, really.
Yeah.
The real action kind of takes place in the space between the three of them. So the three of them had to be the narrators so that that space between the three of them would be ready for the real story to happen in.
Lena has a sister.
Lena has a lot of sister.
who knows everything about everybody.
Oh, every small town has a Noreen. And of course she runs the shop because it's the best access to information.
Yeah. Kind of idea that she married into this, the family who owned the shop, purely so that she would be, you know, get all the gossip first.
Yeah, what better reason? She gets all the gossip. She dishes out all the gossip. Mm. She's this kind of hub for everything that happens in this townland. And she enjoys every minute of it.
Those Dublin Murder Squad books were quite definitely urban books. There's no question about this. These have a different feel. The Searcher and The Hunter have a very different feel to them. We're definitely in a rural setting. We're somewhere in the west of Ireland, but if there's gold in the hills, you can kind of narrow it down to certain parts of the kind of northwest Midlands that have gold or whatever, mining in and around those areas of Roscommon and Leitrim, I guess we're talking about. How do you spend time there?
I don't get down there as much as I'd like to. I love the West. I have since I was a teenager. It is so beautiful and it's got such a different feel to it. Everything from the smell of the air to the rhythm of conversation is different. And yeah, I was saying, what I should really do is go, I've got to go down there for a research trip. It's not a holiday. It's a work thing. I've got to get down there. It's gorgeous.
While there is a mystery going on here and things are being solved and sorted out and worked out, it's not the page turner type of mystery. It's not, you know, you've got to get to the end of the chapter and, oh, there's another short chapter, will I read another one? It's not that type of read. It's a much more, dare I say, literary read in some ways.
Oh, thanks very much. Yeah, I'll definitely take that. I just felt like with a book like this, especially setting it down the country, I've spent enough time down the West to know that the pace is different. Mm. And you've got to let that dictate. It doesn't have that same pressured sense that an urban setting does. And so much is about the interactions between people and the intricacies and the layers within a small town, where every interaction has reverberations throughout the community. So you've got to give that space. Mm. If you're writing about a place like this, you can't just force your plot through at top speed. You've got to give the place time and space.
Yeah. Yeah, to establish itself. And it's not just the place, it's the characters. And this, of course, and people say this about the Dublin Murder Squad books as well, you know, the characters are so well defined. And this, when anything I read by you that has these well established and wonderfully fleshed out characters, I think immediately of your acting background.
I think I definitely write like an actor. The characters are what I care about. Everything else, the plot comes out of the characters, which is probably one of the other reasons why they're a bit slow burn, because the characters have to be established and have to start doing their thing before they can start doing things that have a lot of action in them and you know, the things that go with a boom. You've got to establish the characters first. And that's why I don't really plan my books ahead, because I don't know what's going to happen until I've been writing these people for a while and got a better sense of who feels what way about whom and who'd do what for what reason. So as things unfold, I end up taking myself by surprise as well. But that's what I want. I want the audience to come away feeling like these are people they know intimately, and they care about. So if that's working, I'm delighted.
And the other side of it is, not only do you have those characters, but you have these wonderful set pieces. I mean, obviously the shop provides us for interactions like that, but, you know, scenes in the local pub and things like that, where you really choreograph, you know, the scenes almost like a screenplay or like a stage play. Has that ever been part of, and the dialogue is crisp and wonderful, very well defined by the characters who speak it. Has the idea of the play or the screenplay ever been in your head, or has it always been the novel?
It's always been the novel for some reason. I think it's a whole different skill, play or screenplay, because you have to be leaving half the work for the actors, but at the same time you have to give them work in enough clues and hints that they can do it. It's a much more collaborative process, and it takes this leap of faith where you're going, as a playwright or a screenwriter, I will do half the work and I will trust you, the actors and the director, to do the other half. And I'm not sure I'm skilled enough at this point that I could work those clues in while not spelling everything out like a novel writer does. As a novel writer, anything you want on the page, anything you want to reach the reader, has to be on the page. The playwright has to be working as a collaborator with people they've never met. I don't know how to do that yet.
And do you mean, is it possibly too early to start thinking about that? But anything, lots of the stuff I've read about both The Searcher, but particularly The Hunter in more recent times, and it is very visual, it is very cinematic. Are you nudged in that direction at all?
At the moment, I'm not even thinking that way. There have been people kind of coming, knocking at my agent's door going, what do you reckon? But at the moment, I'm just going, nah, not right now. Partly because what was initially intended as a standalone book seems to be turning into a trilogy here.
Yeah.
Maybe when I've finished the last one, we'll see where we land.
Yeah, so I was going, that was the next question, was, you know, do you feel that there's more in this particular scenario and this set of characters that needs to be ironed out for you? Is it already tickling at you?
You know what it is? There's a kind of arc within these two books where the first one is very much about an outsider in a small town. And The Hunter is very much about people who are in a kind of limbo zone between being insiders and outsiders. They're all peripheral. They're all in this boundary zone where Lena has deliberately distanced herself from the townland because it's too invasive. It works its way into your life too much. And Trey is born and bred there, but she's from that family that every small town has that are basically more trouble than they're worth and are sort of half excluded. And Kyle, obviously, he's American. And that's sort of at the heart of the book, is this liminal zone that they're in. So I went, right, with one book about an outsider, one about that boundary zone, doesn't there need to be one about the idea of being an insider within this small town? What secrets and stories it holds from that perspective? So here I am coming back to it one more time.
So you will I'm thinking of the character of Mark Lavin, who in the Hunter is, you know, kind of holds a lot of secrets. And there's a kind of an omerta thing going on there too, that there are things, you know, you just don't talk about them.
Yeah, and Mart's very good at not talking about things and yet getting his message across. It's fun to write that kind of dialogue because, you know, and it's
that's real
Irish
subtext
thing.
Stuff. Yeah. That's very much an actor's thing again.
Yeah. Actor's dream. And it's also so Irish. This idea that you don't say it, whatever you say, say nothing, but you have to say around it, closer and closer around it until the message gets across. And Mart's an expert at that, so he's fun to write. Oh. I'm hoping I'm writing characters who actors would find fun to play.
Has it changed? I mean, we knew each other back in the day, you know, in your acting days. Has the writing process changed a lot from those early, you know, from the early books? I'm thinking of In the Woods, you know, back in 2007, which seems like a whole century ago nearly. Has the writing process changed for you from those early efforts to where you are now, very well established?
I think the big thing that's changed is I've worked really hard at getting better on structure. It doesn't come naturally to me. Like, I'm comfortable writing characters. I'm comfortable writing like a good sentence. I'm comfortable with atmosphere, but structure didn't come naturally. And possibly it is an acting thing where you're used to the playwright establishing the structure for you. Everything else you have to contribute, but the structure is there and built in, and you can fling yourself on the playwright's mercy for that. And it didn't come naturally to me. So I've worked harder on it. And I don't find it as difficult to structure a book in a way that actually moves forward. It's one reason I write mysteries, because they come with like a built-in structure. And I was worried when I started writing, if I write something that doesn't have this A kills B and C finds out who done it beginning and end, I'm going to keep writing till this thing is a million words long and it's been 10 years and nobody's ever seen it.
Tana, great to speak with you. Continued success, and looking forward to wherever The Hunter brings us for the end of the trilogy. And who knows, it might live beyond a trilogy.
No, I'm done.
It'll be a trilogy and then you're finishing. Okay. Congratulations on The Hunter. Lovely to speak with you this evening.
Sean, thank you so much for having me back. It is a joy to be here.
Tana French speaking to us there about her latest novel, The Hunter, which is published by Penguin Viking. And so to our album reviews on this Friday evening. Audio Vertigo from Elbow, Manchester band's 10th studio album, arrives more than two decades after their debut, Asleep in the Back. Lead singer Guy Garvey says the album is built upon raw, seedy grooves created through collaborative sessions and is characterised by a more direct and diverse sonic approach. Or did his advertiser say that? I'm not sure. Next, Real Power from Gossip, for their first album since reuniting in 2019. First new studio release in 12 years from the Beth Ditto-fronted band. And Glasgow Eyes from the Jesus and Mary Chain, who are celebrating their 40th anniversary with a string of live dates, including the Three Olympia this coming Monday. Hopefully they won't have a row before that. The brothers Simon Marr and Andrea Cleary have been listening to the albums. They're with me in studio this evening. Let us start with Elbow and the opening track on the album, I've Been Telling Myself for Years. Same constant barrister. Things I've Been Telling Myself for Years, the opening track on Audio Vertigo, new album from Elbow. Flying Dream One, the COVID album, is that best left fly off into dreamland?
Yeah, no, look, Simon. Every band is allowed to have their pandemic album, and it's all the amazing stuff about, oh, we were able to write and record even though we were on Zoom and we were miles apart. For Flying Dream One, it just didn't work. Elbow work as a collaborative band, and I think they're the sort of band in that old school way that need to be just in a studio, you know, just coming up with here's the riff, here's, and you'll even hear it on the drum and the bass line on that tune. That's the sort of stuff that makes Elbow work. So yeah, we allow them, we forgive them Flying Dream One, and now they're back to regular Elbow service now and all. Yeah,
does it feel like return to form for you as well, Andrea?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is a band that are often kind of, I think probably fairly lumped in with like a dad rock sort of you know, aesthetic, and I don't mind that. I've defended dad rock on this very show on many occasions.
A bit better than that now.
Well, I would argue yes. I think that here, you know, 10th album, they are doing the things that you ought to be doing on your 10th album, which is expanding your sound a little bit, you know, bringing in different genre influences, big brass, synthesizers, gospel choirs, but also kind of doubling down on what makes the fans love them. And what makes the fans love them, I think, is that voice, which we commented on.
I was just going to say that one of the things that's so important to, no matter what they're going to do, the voice of Guy Garvey at the front. But they're doing a lot. There are times when it's, you know, well, there's a track called Very, Very Heaven, and I wrote down afterwards, Very Elbow, Very Guy Garvey, because it was exactly what you expected from them. But there are times when the voice is still there, but they're pushing it into new places. I think Good Blood Mexico City is a bit of a surprise.
It's very, very different for them, even for them. But I think you're completely right about Guy Garvey, is that he has an unmistakable voice, and you would be mad to mess with that part of the formula, because he's a great storyteller. As well as having a great vocalist, he tells the stories very well. But yeah, there's a risk. Otherwise, if you don't push it into things, there's a risk that you end up being almost a tribute act to seldom seen.
Tribute to yourself.
But to 16 years later, like, you know. Yeah. But they haven't. They've given it a bash.
Let's have a little listen to a bit of Good Blood Mexico City. So the opening section there of Good Blood Mexico City, and it's, I suppose we're slightly misleading as I ask you for stars on this one, Andrea, in that we listen to a little snippet from two songs and you think they're perfectly good songs, but does it all add up?
To me, it doesn't quite. I think we listen to the two best songs on the record, and they come at the beginning and they come at the end.
Yeah.
In between, there's nothing that stands out to me as, you know, uniquely terrible or anything, but they're just aren't those kind of big standout moments that you get on Good Blood Mexico City, or that we got, you know, 16 years ago on Seldom Seen Kid. So for me, it's a 2.5 out of
2.5. I think you're going to be a little bit more dad rock generous than
that. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Well, perhaps being straight in the middle of the dad rock audience probably helps this. But as I said, I was particularly surprised at how much I enjoyed this, because I had listened to Flying Dream 1 and I'd gone, oh no. So there had been a sort of a sense of trepidation listening to this album. But from the start, and perhaps just because the opener is so strong, and there's a lesson in there for every band, is always start with a good, good strong song. But I am happy to give this 4 stars.
You're happy to give it 4 stars. There you go.
Now.
So it started well, it ended well, and it was good in the middle as well. As far as you're concerned. Okay, that is Audio Vertigo from Elbow. Let us move on to, where have I put it? Down here I've put it. Let us move on to Gossip, and the new album, their new album, which is Real Power. Just going to start with the title track of this one. Real power is what Beth Ditto wants. That's what she's telling us in that song, at any rate. I read somebody wrote about Rick Rubin's involvement in this album, Andrea, and how what he had basically done is he's made Gossip a little bit less raucous.
I think you can tell even just from the bells in that song. You're like, Rick Rubin is somewhere
really
here.
Really clean, even though there's lots going on.
There's loads going on. It's really tight. I wasn't expecting there to be such a kind of a funk and disco element to this album, but there really is Real Power. But there's maybe like 3 or 4 tracks on the album that have that kind of disco feeling to them, and it is really clean, it is really tight. This is a band who know how to write hit songs, and I think that they've come back with a really, really strong album.
Yeah, when we say come back, it wouldn't be quite right to say that they split up. There was a bit of a hiatus, yes, as they call it.
Yeah.
Between 2016 and 2019.
Yeah. So they had been recording that, obviously enough, they had appeared 2006 when you think Standing in the Way of Control was. And then there was a slight element of, from 2012 onwards, a bit of a law of diminishing returns on it. So they went on hiatus then 2016, 2019, but never seemed to fall out in the way that many other bands do.
Yeah.
Came back again. The return was relatively okay, but this time it's as if they discovered Rick Rubin, they discovered the value of a really, really good bass line, and just a little bit of restraint on Beth Ditto's voice, which is so good already that it doesn't need to be. Like, Real Power could have been wailed at you,
yeah,
but because it's not, it really lifts the track.
What about Beth Ditto herself? I mean, she is such a force of energy within the musical industry, within the music industry, rather. What's she singing about here, Andrea?
Well, she's a huge, huge figure. I mean, she's really kind of cut from the Riot Girl cloth. She was a major kind of feminist figure, a figure of body positivity during one of the bleakest decades for women to be visible in the music industry or in show business. So we really, really have to give her dues. And I think that here she's grown a bit. You know, there's still a lot of anger and there's still a lot of desire for kind of collective action and for coming together, but there's a bit more of a focus on maybe coming together on the dance floor and coming together in communities, and that's not necessarily detracting from her punk roots. It's just she's sort of coming to it from a place of maturity here.
This sounds like one that I think you both like, Simon.
Yeah, I know, I think so. No, I was really impressed with this, and as I said, I was really impressed. It's as if Rick Rubin went in literally with a laminated set of rules and said, this is what we're going to do here. This will get the best out of this. And they really, really have. And it's almost as if like there's an element of joy. There's a real ease with this.
And stars from you?
3.5.
3.5. Hi, Sean, Andrea and Simon. Love the album review, says Joe and Abby Leakes. Don't know about the album one. So he's a bit, there's a house divided on the album one. Gossip Super, which you both just agreed with, I think. Looking forward to the Jesus and Mary chain, says Joe and Abby Leakes. Wait no longer, Joe and Abby Leakes. Here is the Joseph and Mary chain. And a track that both Andrea and Simon suggested, Jam Cod. A little bit of language in the midst of all this, but he kind of, I think there are a few points being made here by the brothers. There you go. I'm face down on the floor. He's singing in that particular... The brothers, it would seem, have... solved. They're not quite as bad as the Gallagher brothers, really, are they? But they were having fights before the Gallagher brothers were even playing guitars.
They were one of the bands that really invented that fight. But they made the decision that they were going to have their fight on stage. So at a gig in 1998, that's when it all exploded.
William and Jim Reid, of course.
Took them 10 years. Took them 10 years to really decide that they were going to reconcile themselves. And then I think another 10 years before they released another album because they went off to try and find themselves and where they fitted in with the whole musical world. And then a mere 7, 8 years later, here they are back with another one. But this is their first real musical reference.
Yeah, Jam Cod refers to that. And across the album, Andrea, they do refer to other darknesses within their lives as well, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of welcome on that track because we know specifically, you know, the story behind it. But I found a lot of the album to be a kind of darkness for its own sake, or a kind of a bleakness. There was a kind of a bleak and dourness.
Well, you wouldn't be expecting now happy clappy from the Jesus and Mary chain.
I'm not, but I'm expecting a little bit of beauty, which I thought was actually missing from this record. Yeah. It is kind of all dour and no moments that kind of like lift you out of it, which they are brilliant at doing. As
yeah,
we
they
know.
Can give us the brighter side of things. Mm. It is quite industrial and quite dark.
It is.
Part,
no,
it,
they have decided they made a very definite decision here that every bit is going to be lots of electronics, lots of distortion, all of that sort of stuff. And a lot of the time you get the feeling that underneath it all, there are actually some really good songs. There's always going to be really good stories. But you get the feeling that when you listen, so people who go and see them next week and they'll hear Just Like Honey, and then they'll hear, you know, Jam Cod will go, what is going on here? And there's no need to dull the beauty quite so much.
All right. See them next week. Are they here? Are they here? Did I say they were here? Are they the ones that are... Yes, they're in the Olympia. I wonder. Yeah. There we go. So they will go and see. Will you go and see them?
I'd go and see them in probably 1998, hoping that I'd get a reprise of the row. But but I have a suspicion that an hour of this might be a little bit hard on the ears.
Yeah, because this is a short enough album, and it does kind of take a fair bit of listening. What are you saying stars-wise, Andrea?
I'm saying there's interesting moments in the album, but listening as a whole starts to get a bit dour and uninteresting. So it was 2.5.
2.5, Simon?
Yeah, I think 2.5 is very fair for that, yeah.
So agreement on that one as well for Glasgow Eyes, The Jesus and Mary Chain. Agreement on Real Power Gossip. Not so sure about Audio Vertigo in terms of Albo. Simon Marr and Andrea Clary are two reviewers on this Friday evening. Now, who is out in the production area? Will I manage it? We'll have a go at it. David Phelan was the broadcast coordinator. Harry Bookless was on sound. Research this evening was by Leah Murphy. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. I'm going home to lie down for the rest of the weekend. I will talk to you on Monday. John Creedon will be with you after the news.